So Karen, we're doing something that we often say we're going to do and we actually almost never do.
What's that?
Well, we always say we're going to record and broadcast from, not broadcast because it's delayed, but record at a conference when we go to these conferences. And we lug the equipment around, usually you, sometimes me.
We have done it in the past.
But we've never really
recently,
done it on the show.
Well, that's not true. We recently published the show where we interviewed Allison at Libre Planet.
Ah, but we did not record the whole show. We recorded just the interview. What I'm talking about is recording the whole show.
Oh, I see.
Getting together at a conference and recording a show. And here we are.
Here we are.
In a squatted room at OSCON.
Kind of amazing considering how busy we both have been this conference.
And we actually, a little earlier today, did an interview here at the conference.
Yes, it was today.
And we have a recording of that interview.
We do. We interviewed Jim Zemlin. Who is the executive director, is that his title? I think that's his title. Of the Linux Foundation.
And let me set up this clip. So, so I can set up this clip. So we, yesterday, here at OSCON, had a session that covered the various fiscal sponsors and organizations where projects
can
join.
By we, Bradley means Bradley had a session and Jim Zemlin participated in it. I participated by being in the audience.
That's true, but we, as the collective we, as this community. So I've learned from Simon Phipps. I've learned from Simon Phipps, you just say we all the time, and it makes people think that that you're more in charge of more things than
well,
you are.
Well, in the interview, you said the same kind of vague we about the panel, and I just didn't want people to be confused whether I was on the panel or not.
That's true, and I actually typically avoid ambiguous uses of we and other first-person plurals, but...
We all wear a lot of hats, and so it's gets very sloppy.
And people abuse and manipulate that sloppiness.
They certainly
very
do.
Very often. And
yeah.
I try to avoid that, but today I've kind of been in the abuse of the first person plural kind of mood. So I've done a lot of it today. And you'll hear some of that in this interview that we're about to listen to from Jim Zemlin and Karen and I doing a little interview of him about his work at the Linux Foundation and what the Linux Foundation is doing that relates to what our listeners are interested in. We try to keep the discussion in that realm.
Here you go.
So Karen, we're here at OSCON. Doing hopefully a few interviews and
right. I know where we are.
Yeah, well, our listeners don't. So yesterday we had a session where we introduced the audience to various different nonprofit organizations that are available for projects to affiliate with and get various services from.
And you were the moderator, Bradley.
I was, and I also presented Conservancy, which our listeners have heard a lot about in the past. But also on the panel was Jim Zemlin. I tricked him by telling him it was a keynote, and he came. And he talked about the Linux Foundation. We have Jim here to tell us a little bit about how, and we want to get a little geeky about nonprofit-y stuff because that's what our listeners are into.
This is what we do.
All right.
So you run, and our listeners are very much more familiar with the C3, 501c3 stuff than the 501c6 because obviously Karen and I run C3,
so
we tell
about
them about
it incessantly.
Yeah, talk about the C3s and C3s.
We do.
Yeah,
our
listeners love this stuff.
We even have episodes where we walk through our 990, which would be really boring
to
most people.
Reading tax documents. These are the kind of listeners we have, Jim. And so why don't you tell them
awesome
a little bit?
Awesome listeners.
Yeah. Indeed. Why don't you tell them a little bit about like what you see is the difference between a 501c3 and a 501c6?
Well, the Linux Foundation is a C6 nonprofit, and the tax code in the United States is extremely complicated. Mm-hmm. Anybody who goes and actually reads through the code, and this has been a subject of, you know, people who want to see tax reform and simplification, and particularly when it comes to nonprofit organizations, it's complicated. But I've read the code, and I think the easiest way to think about it is that a C6 is twice as good as a C3.
How's that?
Well, because the Linux Foundation is a C6, and you see 3 times 2, that's 6. Twice as good.
You delivered it so straight. I thought you were serious.
Okay, the key difference, and we don't have to get too much into the details. Key difference is that we're always telling our listeners is 501c3s are focused on some general benefit for the public good, and C6s are primarily focused on helping an industry, which I think is
right.
Something
it's,
you've
it's
done a great job.
It's actually a common business interest. Right. So defining that industry or that common business interest can be a little tricky.
Wait, we So we can't be for the public good?
No, I don't think that's correct. I think it's really a question of mandates. So
I'm joking. Of course, yeah.
Indeed, you do,
and that's the work we do in public good.
And I think that's. I mean, I think the Linux Foundation does a lot in the public good, but the primary purpose and the sort of what the IRS is expecting to do is, at the very least, make sure that a common business interest is upheld and pushed forward. So why don't you talk about what
we like to think we do even more.
And you do even more. And any of course, any org can do even more. But why don't you sort of explain for our listeners what the kind of common business interest that Linux Foundation is focused on?
Well, we also are focused on the public good.
Indeed.
To be clear.
So yeah, I agree completely that you guys are operating both in the public good and as a trade association to help the industry. So why don't you talk about some of the, like, how does Linux Foundation do that when it wants to act both to help the public good and to help the industry?
Well, you know, when I think about what we do, the thing that I think about the most, the thing that, you know, is important to me is how to sustain an effort like this for a very long period of time, you know, 50 years, 100 years. And I often think...
We're next to the elevator.
Yes.
You can have an image.
So, you know, how do you sustain this for 50, 100 years? I often think of a quote that Evan Moglen, a statement that Evan Moglen made at our 20th anniversary event, which is he described Linux and open source free software as the coal and steel of the information age. And rather than being owned by the Carnegies or, you know, anyone like that, it's owned by all of us. And that's just so important, right? And what we do is try to build an organization that can sustain, you know, Linux and the other projects that we work on for a long, for after I am gone, you know, after we're all gone, so that coal and steel remains shared. I think that is really important. That's what we think about all the time.
And that's kind of, I mean, I think one of the things when you compare it to organizations like GNOME Foundation and Software Freedom Conservancy, because you've said before that it's good to have all of us and it's important that we have all these different orgs. The thing I see you doing really well at Linux Foundation is being able and prepared to handle larger projects that a large number of companies want to get together and work on. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to hear more about how you do it, because you've done a lot of those kinds of things. You've done like Open Mama and Open Daylight. So talk about the process of how you end up with a project like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see that we even have these type of large scale collaborations, that people are wanting to invent collectively under a free software license, and business as well as individuals see it as a better way to innovate, a better, faster, cheaper way to get to market. I mean, even 20 years ago, it wasn't so. You know, it wasn't companies that were starting these kind of projects. It was, you know, a guy in his dorm room in Helsinki, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a great turn of events. You know, what we see now is large organizations, industry, in some cases individuals, will come to us and say, you know, I don't need to be convinced anymore that working together on, let's say, a software-defined networking controller or low-latency middleware technology, if you're the financial service industry, I don't need to be convinced that collaborating with my competitors and business partners is a good idea. What I need to know is exactly how you do it. Which license should I pick? What kind of, you know, governance structure for the project can I use that will allow for me to, with integrity, interact with my competitors, right? How do I assure a neutral playing field? This is something that free software and open source projects have been sort of the existence proof of. How do you get, you know, the fiercest competitors to work together in an open and transparent way? And that's what really all of these projects that we're working on are all about. Albeit at somewhat large scale.
Well, and that's what amazes me. Right?
Oh, I was just going to ask: do these initiatives ever fall apart at the early at the early stages? Because what the public sees are just the big projects that you
that's
managed
the way
to
we
make
like
incredibly
it.
Successful.
That's the way we like it. You know, there's always going to be winners and losers in the technology industry. Mm. What's really interesting for me is that, you know, before you would have sort of open source versus proprietary, and would the proprietary guys beat out the open source guys, right? And could sort of crush them, or, you know, remember those days where all of us were so concerned about, and legitimately so, right, about, you know, proprietary incumbents who were, you know, FUD in the marketplace, legal channel, all these things.
I'm still worried about those, but
I was going to say, maybe I'm entirely out of the woods.
But I think in some sectors, you're right.
I agree. But more importantly, in that, and I do agree that there's it should always be something that's important. I'm not trying to diminish that fact. I think it's gotten better, is my
point. Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
And what I mean by that is now it's not proprietary versus open source. It's competing open source initiatives. It's OpenStack versus CloudStack, right? It's, you know, becoming now a marketplace of all these different open source projects. Will some be more successful than others? Will some succeed where others fail? Probably. You know, I think that's going to happen. I like to think we can help the lion's share of the projects that we work with succeed, but I'm not going to claim that anybody's perfect. And, you know, the technology industry changes so rapidly that you have to constantly be adapting. And, you know, we think we can set any project up with the right ingredients for success. But, you know, obviously, like, anyone can't guarantee success.
Right. And conservancies used to dealing with the projects that are small, started in a basement type of thing. I mean, that's the kind of communities that a conservancy tends to serve. And as far as funding and that sort of thing go, the smaller groups of developers. But you've done a good job at Linux Foundation serving these huge initiatives that if somebody were to come to me with the $10 million and want to put money into doing an open source initiative, I'd send them to you. And it seems like you have really put together an org that can hit the ground running on that. So I don't know if you want to share any of your secrets, but sort of how did you build up, and as a management aspect, how do you get everybody together and get those things moving quickly? Because that's what a for-profit industry is going to expect. They're going to expect they come to somebody like you and say, you're going to get me moving fast, right?
Well, let's start with I think what, again, is a more historically important question, which is why are both our organization organizations and Karen's organization, the GNOME Foundation, the Software Research Conservancy, or the Linux Foundation, why are they all important? Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at, historically, there's been two forms of collaboration in the tech industry for a long period of time. There was the standard setting bodies, the ISOs, IEEEs, the W3Cs. These are extremely well-equipped, well-funded, well-respected organizations. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you had, you know, open source developers who were sort of working out of, to use your words, their basements or the dorm room, you know, and sort of, you know, they had a bug tracker and a mailing list, an IRC. What's interesting is now you see organizations like all of ours, which are, you know, professionally organized places where people can come and set up a infrastructure to do broad scale collaboration. You know, whether it's a really big project at the Linux Foundation or a smaller project at the Software Freedom Conservancy, I think they're all equally important. The other thing that I would add, when I look across all of these organizations, and I would even say to you, Bradley, or to anyone, don't think small. That dorm room project could be the next Linux.
Oh, and, right? And indeed, and there are conservancy projects that we have that become huge. We have the PyPy project, which has become this big thing in the Python community. We didn't know it when they joined that they were going to be the flavor of the month. But I think what I'm really interested in is how Linux Foundation has succeeded in these hit the ground running large projects, because you've done a few of them now. You've done Open Mama, you're doing Open Daylight. I think you don't want to share your secrets, is what it is. You don't want to tell us like how you pull that off, because it's impressive. I went to see your Open Daylight announcement, I'm like, this thing is there. There's a there in a matter of weeks. That's pretty impressive.
Or was it not a matter of weeks? We only saw the tip of the iceberg.
I don't think there's any secret, because when I looked at all the different organizations here at OSCON yesterday that discussed how the Apache Software Foundation or the Eclipse Foundation or the Software Freedom Conservancy operate, what services they provide for projects in terms of an IP regime, in terms of governance, in terms of, you know, all of the business infrastructure to support them, they're all very similar. And so I don't think that's a huge, huge secret in terms of how to set up the nuts and bolts of what we do. What I spend a lot of my time doing is not necessarily setting up the project, but it's going to a business executive in an industry that may not be familiar with free software or open source development, that may not understand that collaborative development is a better path for them business-wise, and explaining the business case for it
let me give you an example. We have a project called the Automotive Grade Linux Initiative, right? Now you look at the automotive industry. This is an industry that is conservative, right? Because they have long production cycles, they have they're regulated, they, you know, the impact of a mistake in the auto production process can be, you know, hugely expensive.
We're by the water fountain.
Yeah, this is the loudest water fountain I've ever heard. In fact, actually, there's a couple of other podcasts where they talk about how at the conferences you always end up interviewing by the bathrooms, but this is the first time we are by the bathrooms, but we're also by this loud water fountain. But I think it's done now, so we'll try to edit that out. Go ahead.
But let me be clear with the automotive industry, conservative industry, right? Their biggest competitor right now is an iPad and a piece of Velcro that people affix to their dashboards, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rather than using the navigation system and the entertainment system inside a car, they're using just that iPad. In other words, the automotive industry is now competing with the computing requirements of the consumer electronics industry. So how should they compete? How do they react, right? And the business case that we've made to them, successfully, I might add, if you look at members of the Automotive Grade Linux Initiative, you've got Toyota, the world's largest car maker, you know, Jaguar Land Rover, the kind of car I wish I could afford. but you have, you know, this tremendous group of companies who now understand that they can compete effectively with the consumer electronics industry if they take advantage of the billions of dollars of free software out there that they can harness for the underlying operating system, middleware components, the UI frameworks. I mean, there's lots of GNOME technology these folks are using. There's just tons of great free software they can use. And they focus on how to take advantage of the car as a unique user experience, how to take advantage of the sensor network within a car, which contains hundreds of different inputs from the tires to the rear camera to, you know, all the outside and indoor temperature, all of these different things, rather than focus on building a new kernel or building a new set of middleware. I spend a lot of time explaining how the business case works, how they can integrate open source and free software into their product development process, how to, in that product development process, upstream code to the mainline projects so they don't have to maintain a forked code base over time, right? You know, because the whole reason they're doing this is to collaborate. That's where I spend a ton of time, because what that results in is getting more code out into the open, because we've reached this incredibly cool moment in history where business interest and social good, which we kind of started with in this conversation, mm-hmm. align. Right, it's not only good for Toyota to use Linux and free software because they can build more advanced, better products for their customers, but it's good for everyone because this is a shared asset that betters society, and that's, it's cool to be a part of that.
I mean, I think it's interesting. The GNOME Foundation operates under, you know, sort of similar principles, and we come at it from the C3 perspective, not the C6 perspective, and it's still, we rely on the corporate, you know, the corporations that use GNOME technologies to keep the foundation alive. And so the community is very C3-based community, very charity-based community, but at the same time, we've got this corporate component. But I want to know is, how do you balance, during that discussion with these companies, how do you balance the explanation, sort of the sell of free and open source software is that you're going to save money in the long run, that this is sort of a sane and appropriate business model to approach. How do you balance that with the explanation that you still have to pony up some money to keep these things going and to develop them properly?
Yeah, I mean, so saving money is important, but I think it's getting to market quicker and innovating at higher levels that's more important to these companies. I don't think the money matters as much to a lot of these firms. What they really care about is, if I'm building my own kernel, I'm not building my advanced user experience, right? If I, you know, if I'm Netflix and I'm building, you know, my own operating system, my own middleware, I'm doing all of this infrastructure by myself, I've spent all my money there. I haven't spent it on my, you know, Emmy-nominated programming,
which is what my customers...
They are spending on their DRM, you know. Netflix is a bad example to use with this crowd. You know that, Jim.
Fair enough. If only you could see some of those Netflix shows. They're awesome.
My wife watches them. I mean, really? Admittedly. They come into my household. I stay away.
Fair enough.
They are good. Are they available in any other format?
No, not really. That's actually something
Netflix.
But I think the point is...
Instead of investing in an OS, we're investing in advanced DRM. I will cede my point. But the broader point is, and you asked about how people see contributing back to the community financially or with code. I'll take the latter first. The code contributions back to the community, this is what I spend a ton of time on. Making sure companies are clear. When you're working on using free and open source software, it is important to take your changes and get them back into the mainline.
Yep.
Well, and actually, I know this, I can ask because I know a little bit about how it works, because I've talked to Greg KH that you work with regularly about this.
Sure.
I mean, I've heard, Greg sort of told me stories that I think our listeners would be interested to hear. You and he go into these companies together.
The Greg and Jim show, yeah.
Yeah, and then you're sort of talking to business executives and he's in there talking to the hackers. Tell us a little bit what those meetings are like, because I think that's a really neat initiative that you guys do.
Yeah, so we, Greg's a fellow at the Linux Foundation,
indeed.
And when he came to the Linux Foundation, I told him, like, you know, think of us, Greg, and most importantly, he's like the artist, right? Mm-hmm. You know, see, he's the rock star in Linux, right? And let's think of the companies that use this stuff as the record labels, right? The record labels make all the money in the recording industry, right?
Of course.
How does the rock star make money? They go on tour. And so Greg and I created the Jim and Greg show, right? We have to go on tour, we sell a few t-shirts, which is a funny way to think of it, but the important result that we get is we go into organizations and show them they have an inkling that they need to, well, they're already using Linux and open source software, but they want to know how to integrate it into their production process, right? And most importantly, they want to understand how to get their changes back into the mainline. And so Greg's really effective at showing them at the timing, the need for the quality of those patches to be ones that, you know, aren't so exclusive to them that they can't be applied to anything else. And it's usually not a problem to show them that. And it's certainly never counter to their business goals to do their development that way. I simultaneously talk to the business people to say, listen, the whole reason you're doing this, collaborating, is so that you can get products built better, faster, cheaper. If you don't contribute back to the mainline projects, you're defeating the whole purpose. Because then what you're doing is forking your code base, which you'll have to maintain by yourself over time. And you will never succeed at that, because Linux changes 9 times an hour, 10,000 lines a day, right? You just, no single company could or should do that, because it's just inefficient. And so we go all over the world and talk to developers about how to work with the community, talk to business people about why they should allow their developers to work with the community, and it's pretty fun. I think I spent one day 7 hours in a small Korean taxi driving all over Korea with Greg, who's like 6'5".
So that's, I think that's excellent work, and it's a great example, I think, for our listeners who are obsessed with this. You know, what do trade associations do? What do nonprofits do? It sounds like you guys are doing a full spectrum of work to help really promote Linux and free software through a nonprofit. And so is there anything else? I just want to wrap up.
What's coming down the pipeline from the Linux Foundation?
What's coming down the pipeline? More Linux, for sure. You know, one of the things that we like to do is, if we look across the pantheon of, the different technology sectors, from embedded to consumer electronics to mobile devices to desktop and so forth, you know, we really want to reach out to those technologies that can become adopters. You know, 10 years ago, it was the telco industry, where Sun and Solaris were really the incumbents, and we worked with that industry, and now Linux really completely dominates that. Today, it's the automotive industry, right? Tomorrow, I think it could be the wearable device industry, right? I think that's a new category of computing that's perfectly suited to using open source and free software to produce these wonderful products that can change our lives, can monitor our health conditions in real time, that, you know, can use these billions of dollars of free software to build the devices and then concentrate on adding value by, you know, creating algorithms to make sense of all the data that's being connected in these wearables rather than the operating system that's in the particular wearable device that you've got on you.
Algorithms that will be publicly available because they're free and open source software.
Sure,
which then patients, if they can advocate and get their own data, would be able to evaluate. Yeah. I'm just saying.
More transparency is always better. I'm gonna start small, we'll get big.
So Jim, I wanna thank you for you know, hiding in a corner with lots of elevator and water fountain noise to talk to us on our little podcast here. And I think our listeners are really gonna enjoy what you had to say. Thanks a lot for
joining
us.
Thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
So interviewing Karen interviewing Jim, to me, Jim has a way of making it feel like you know he's a big get.
He's a big what?
Get, you know, like we got a big famous Jim Zemlin.
He's very busy.
It's true, he's very busy, but he has a way of about himself.
Well, it's funny because in all of his talks, he's like, self-deprecation is a huge portion of his like public persona.
True.
So he always gives. He always gives talks where he says that he has no control over, you know, Linus Torvalds, and he says that, you know, he sometimes describes himself as, you know, not being that influential. And I think that
Linus has recently been saying on LKML, I think you want to admit that you don't have control over what's happening there, to be honest. I think that's just shrewdness on Jim's part to make it clear that it's not his fault, the kind of things that Linus says sometimes. But I think what might interest me, and the reason I asked him at the end about the stuff with Greg KH, is Greg had told me about that work. And I think, I've often said the Linux Foundation is kind of what I would envision a trade association to really be for free software, or mm-hmm. open source, since it's a trade association. It really does the kinds
Wait,
of activities.
What? Sorry. I missed that. You were saying that because it's a trade association.
Well, because it's more business focused. Open source is the business.
You know,
term.
This is another vague, weird.
Open source is a business
terminology.
Yeah, okay, but it's a business term. The point is, Linux Foundation is a business oriented. All I'm trying to say, let's not debate that again, because our listeners will be annoyed.
Again.
But I'll restate
it's
so you
so
don't
weird.
Have to.
Thank you.
Linux Foundation is clearly a business-oriented adoption type of organization that's encouraging people to adopt the software that we love that is licensed freely.
Adapt and develop.
And develop, yes. Yeah. So, and I think that Linux Foundation is a really good example of what a trade association can do and how it can be helpful.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think that a lot of the things that they focus on from, you know, the like sort of that sales role that Jim was describing, where he and Greg go on the road, to we didn't talk about the conference organizing, but that's a big portion of what the Linux Foundation does as well, being a meeting place for these business entities to talk about, you know, their common business interest. All that is pretty classic trade association style work, and I think they do a great job at it.
And I actually do agree with Jim that this has sort of been a tenor of a conversation. There's a number of things happening in the free software community right now that have, there's certain memes going around that I think are inaccurate, and people just keep restating them to make them true. And one of those memes that I've heard this week in sort of the foundations thread, the nonprofits thread that's happening at this conference, because there was a tutorial on Tuesday at OSCON and my session, is this idea that, oh, there's really no difference between 501c6 trade associations and 501c3 charities. And that conflation really bothers me.
I'm with you.
But yeah. I think Jim's point is good. Jim's point is actually good
on
that.
Yeah, that the C6 can also do things in the public good.
But it's not required to. That's the key. And the other C6 leaders, I've been in debates with them just this week here at OSCON about the issue, because they want to say, well, then we're just like them. we're just like, we're the same kind of thing. We're just trying to promote, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And there's really no difference in how we operate. And I think that's kind of false. If you look at the salaries alone. And actually, it was funny, Paula Hunter, the Outer Curve Foundation, was making these really strong points about, oh, C6s are no different than C3s, really. And then when we had the session at the tutorial about foundations on staffing, and she made the argument that this is a classic argument in nonprofits, actually, where people argue, should you pay matching for-profit wages to attract talent, or should you assume, which I think is a correct assumption, that you'll attract talent at lower, you know, reasonable wages, but not exorbitant wages, because people care about the cause.
Right, that's the thing about us, right? We take less money because we care deeply about the organizations
and to correct the first person plural thing there, the two of us sitting here today together. And I think, and Paul was making this point that you have to do that, and I said, well, that's not really true.
You'd have to pay us a lot more to work at a trade association.
Yeah, exactly. And I pointed this out when Paul had said this, that she had left out the point about the debate, and she actually answered that, well, in a C6, it's different because you need professional marketing that can be focused towards business, which is that kind of talent's hard to draw. And that's actually, it was funny that she made my point for me, that yes, C6s are different.
See how different they are?
Yeah. Exactly, because they do have to market to businesses. And that's sort of what I was getting to, was asking about what Jim's able to do. He's able to execute in a very for-profit-ish way. A great example is Open Daylight, when it joined Linux Foundation, it was very fast. And I know this from Phil Robb, who helped Phil Robb as well. He moved from HP to Linux Foundation, mm-hmm. in part to help Open Daylight. And yeah. It was all executed very quickly. And that's something a trade association can do when there's interest and there's a hot opportunity, they can capitalize on it. It's not that C3s can't do that. It's tougher for us to do that because the resources is hard for us to marshal the resources to act quickly.
Yep.
And that's why Conservancy has a queue that takes a long time to get projects into Conservancy and so forth. And I know GNOME has a lot of things it wants to do that you move slower than you'd like because of resources.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, but we do the best we can.
Right, and yeah. I think that's a key difference. But I think another point that I like that Jim made is something that I said, we need all these different organizations and we need them to be established and last.
Right, well, every organization that was represented on that panel, you know, and then also GNOME Foundation, each of us fill a different role, a different niche. And being a C3 or a C6 is a different component, you know, is one piece of that puzzle.
And so I have to admit, I was so busy chairing that panel and getting it all coordinating because I had to put all the slides together. We didn't have transition time, so I had to use LibreOffice, which I rate the LibreOffice free software. I don't like GUIs, and everyone knows that. So, but it was the lowest common denominator. I thought everybody can handle it, well, except for the Outer Curve Foundation preferred PPTX, but generally speaking, everybody was okay with that was the common denominator, because I don't do my slides in LibreOffice normally, but it's free software. And so, uh-huh. So I collected all the slides in LibreOffice, and I was like, even up to the last minute, trying to put them together and dealing with the weird save issues I had in LibreOffice and stuff. So I forgot actually to whip out the recorder and actually record that session.
Oh, okay.
But what I'm gonna do is I will put the slides up in the show notes,
so
people can at least look at the slides and see everybody who presented. And Jim, actually one of the reasons I wanted to interview Jim is he asked to go last, and so we decided we'll do it by alphabetical by last name. So
Zemlin
was indeed last, and what he wanted to do, because what he wanted to do was sort of summarize why all these nonprofits were important.
That's great.
And I think that was great. And,
yeah.
and so that's why that's one of the reasons I wanted to have Jim on the show, so he could do that summary, and then you could look at the slides and see the different orgs, and obviously email us in with questions.
Yeah, well, I have to say that I'm very. I'm always impressed with Jim as executive director of a trade association and as an executive director of an organization full stop, and I feel like I've actually learned quite a bit from him.
Jim is the best fundraiser I've ever met, to be honest.
maybe what I'm talking about in large part.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's really good at that.
Part of that is just his ability to talk to people and to get, you know, to get these points across.
Yeah.
So it's largely fundraising, but it's also, you know, it's also doing the meat of the work as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I can't sort of like loud enough the 1-2 punch of him and Greg going around. And Greg has told me a lot about his work doing that.
Mm.
And it
Maybe
really
we should
is
have Greg on the show.
Yeah, we should have Greg on the show. But Greg's work doing that is really, for those who listen who haven't met Greg, Greg is a rare find as a developer, but particularly in the kernel Linux community. He really can communicate to other developers, and he's very didactic in the way he presents, but not in a condescending way. He really will walk people through, and that comes from, I think that comes from his experience working on USB stuff and so many devices and trying to support devices and talked to so many people trying to get a device, a USB device working with Linux, which is what he spent many, many years doing. Device after device, send me the device, I'll try to make it work. And I think that made him, that sort of helped him, I think he already had natural talent towards it, but also it molded him into this person that can really walk technical developers through it, understand how to participate in a development community.
That's great.
And Greg is not a doormat. I want to make clear, I do not believe Greg is a doormat.
I don't find that either.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's, I think he's really, you know, one of the best personalities we have in working, you know,
at least in Linux for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Are you saying all free software wide?
Free software wide. He's a really good example. You know, I mean, when he comes to, you know, GNOME Hackfest types events, you know, I'm always impressed with how he interacts, and I think he's a good model to follow.
And that phrase about Greg being a doormat, at this point we've mentioned this thread twice. I'll also link to that thread in the show notes if you have not seen the thread where
I met Sarah Sharp today for the first time in person.
Here.
I've obviously talked to her a lot, because she's instrumental in having the Linux kernel participation in the outreach program for women.
Yeah, so folks probably want to listen to read that thread and understand what we're talking about.
To wrap that, to bring it all around, was those spots were, many of them were funded by Linux Foundation.
The outreach program for women spots for the Linux kernel developers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the kernel named Linux. Yeah.
Anyway, I hope you liked the interview, and thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody, and hopefully the show will be out quickly after OSCON. We're going to try anyway.
Freeze and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Freeze and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Freeze and Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Freeze and Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us. Can we do that again?
Yeah, I'll figure this out because it's...